without any further ado, I'd like to introduce a very lovely lady. She came here from a long distance away, and I think that you'll be very pleased to hear Holly M. from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And up until this time, this present moment, I've been having a lovely time up until now. In fact, to tell you, from the moment I stepped off of the plane, I had a, you might call it a spiritual experience. That's about the only thing I think I could call it. When I got off the plane, this is why I say it's a spiritual experience. There were three Al-Anons there, and two people from AA, and all five of these people were smiling, I guess you say, well, what's wrong about that? Well, I've stepped off of other planes in other places at certain times, and they might have three or four Al-Anons or three or four AAs, and they were women, why, the ones sit on one side of the room, the others would be standing on the other side, looking one another up and down as if to say, who's got on dirty underwear? But I saw a beautiful unity there, which I deeply appreciate. A little warm in here. I'll try not to keep you all night long. But do you know, one time there was a man that used to like to ride his friend who had tried to help him to come into AA, and he would ride him about everything. This man had been in the program for quite some time, and he was trying his best to be a very tolerant, patient person. So the man started on him one day about his church affiliations, and the good fellow from AA took it very nicely. So he figured, well, I'll really get under his skin. I'll light in on him about AA. So he lit in on him about AA. He says, you know, that thing you belong to that they call AA, so that must be something like Noah's Ark. The man says, well, what makes you think that? He says, well, you know, with all those many people, it's got to be like Noah's Ark. He said, with those many people there, there's got to be some gossip. Because I'm sure there was some gossip in Noah's Ark with all those people. And he says, there's got to be some filth, because with all those animals that was in Noah's Ark, he said, I'm sure there was some filth. The man had finally come to the end of his patience, and he said to him, you know one thing? He says, that's about the best definition that you could give me. He said, AA is very much like Noah's Ark. We do have some gossip and we do have some filth, but everybody that stays in it stays dry, just like the business. Which is true. After all, as the theme says, we're not going to be perfect, say, but we do make progress. I thought I would never make any progress at all for the very simple reason when I first came to AA, I wanted to do a Rip Van Winkle. If I could have just laid down and went to sleep for 5 years and woke up with 5 years of sobriety, I'd have been happy, but it don't work like that. I found out. The big book tells us that our stories reveal in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we are like now. Well, you know, I'm not going to stand here hot as it is tonight and go through all that blow-by-blow description of what I used to be like. For the very simple reason is I wouldn't be here tonight if I had been like I am now. It's a known fact. I could sum it up in all in one word. I was a wino, but you don't, women aren't winos, they're winettes. You know? I wasn't born to wine yet, of course, and wine was not the first beverage that I ever tasted in my life. What really and truly happened, I think I took my first drink out of curiosity. In fact, I know I took it out of curiosity. I used to see my grandfather. There was a bottle there. He had in the drawer. My grandfather had arthritis awfully bad. And on wet, rainy days, he would go there and he would take a drink out of it. He'd cripple over there. Oh, I mean, his leg would be hurting him so very badly. And he would cripple over there so badly. And he'd open this dresser drawer and he would take 2-3 swigs out of that bottle and he would rub his leg and sit there for a while and rub his leg and he'd walk away. I watched this. I walked over there one day and I took 2-3 swigs out of that bottle and I crippled away. Very potent stuff it was. That was my first drink. But there was something about alcohol and I that we had, shall we say, a going thing for a number of years. And as I told you, I'm not going to bore you with it. I'm sure most of you in here know what it means to wake up at 6 o'clock. The clock says 6, but you just don't know which 6 it is. And you would like to ask, but you wouldn't dare do that. You lay there, and it's twilight. You don't know whether it's early morning or late evening. And you wish somebody would cook something. Of course, you're going to puke if they do. But then that would tell you if it was bacon, it was morning. Or if just something would happen so you'd know what 6 it is. And you lay there, and you want a drink of water so badly. But if you get up and go get a drink of water, somebody's going to say, they're either going to say two things. Are you just now coming in, or what are you getting up so early for? So you don't want to hear that. So you lay there a little bit longer, and finally, you got to go potty. And you don't want to do, they're going to ask you the same question if you go in the bathroom, so you don't do that. So you lay there and suffer at both ends. Yeah. I'm sure you know about that. And then, of course, I may know something that I don't think maybe many of you didn't experience. I did. I experienced pawn shops. I had a wristwatch that stayed in the pawn shop so much it wouldn't run on a Jewish holiday. So much for that. You know, it was so strange, you know, all of a sudden, you hear so much today about X factor, the alcoholic's supposed to have an X factor. Someone was saying not too long ago, I didn't hear you say anything about the X factor, Holly. I didn't come up here to talk about any X factor. I said, I've had X's all my life. I was expelled, I said, from school. I was exiled. I've been excommunicated. I got 2 ex-husbands. Now, how many more X's am I supposed to have? I'll take it as it is, you know, and I don't hide behind my alcoholism. I don't come up with... Now, I'm not saying people don't have this. They do have these things, but damn, I never saw so many people with hypoglycemia. Manic depression. Anything but just come out and say, look, I am a drunk. Those kind of things. A recovering alcoholic. And that, of course, I never like to think of myself as a recovered alcoholic, because when you say the word recovered, I don't believe in that anyway. It sounds like, you know, you've been put in a box and shoved in the ground and somebody took the shovel and patted the dirt on you. Recovered. You've been covered twice. First that box and then the dirt. That's recovered to me. I prefer recovering because that's what I feel that I am. And there's another thing that's always very gratifying to me, very gratifying. Whenever I'm asked to share with some group or with a person or people, and it happens on a Saturday night, and I will tell you why it is so gratifying. The first time I ever heard about AA was on a Saturday night. And this was the beginning of a miracle, because this particular Saturday night, I happened to be at home. That was most unusual. And I was sitting at the kitchen table, not alone. I had a bottle of wine there. And this story came on over the radio and was called The Glass Crutch. Now, I did not turn the radio on to that story when you were in the condition that I was in. You didn't turn radios on to any particular station. You just bought one and plugged it in and it played till it give out. Because I heard voices all the time anyway. It didn't make any difference with the radio. But nevertheless, This story, it was about a woman. I don't think I'd have paid any attention to it if it hadn't been about a woman. It was about a woman that had a drinking problem, and I don't today remember any of the ingredients of the story. All I can recall is it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. And said, if you ever need our help, we'll be the first number in the book. And I thought if that broad would just get herself some good, cool, clean wine, she wouldn't need those people. But if any of you have ever read The Hound of Heaven, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But the simple reason is this. If he wants you, he's going to get you. You know, all you've got to do is just show a little willingness whatsoever. For the next 6 or 7 years, not every day, not every week, not every month, but that story that I had heard, those few words that sunk in, they haunted me, the glass crutch. There were times in my life when I would be walking down the street and it seemed as if my heel plates on my shoes would beat out the words, the glass crutch. But my mind was so fogged, I didn't know what it meant. I can remember listening to the clock. You know, that's how loud a clock can sound when you're in a room all by yourself. But the clock didn't say tick-tock, it said the glass crutch, the glass crutch. I remember one day trying to read a newspaper. And it seemed as if every word on that paper said the glass crutch. And I said, oh, Lord, what does this mean? And my eyes left that paper and wandered down on my hand. And here I sat with my glass crutch, that bottle of wine, or glass, whatever it was. It would sound dramatic to say that immediately I dropped the glass or whatever I had in my hand and ran to the phone, but I didn't do no such thing. I said, if there's anything wrong with me, I can straighten it out myself. You know, we don't do a very good job of straightening things out. But finally, that day did come. Many things happened during those 6 or 7 years. And you know, there's something that stays on my mind and comes back to my mind every once in a while. Especially when I look at my two very adult children now. They're beautiful people. But I remember one time waking up. See, my children never, ever, when they came home, ever saw me ever sitting down. I was always very busy doing something. You know how busy drunks stay all the time. They got to be doing something. One thing that stayed on my mind, and sometimes now when I am around one of my people, and I see that look in their eyes, I remember laying on the couch. This was the beginning of that drinking in the morning. And for me to be laying down in the daytime or early in the morning, this was something very unusual for my children because, as I said, I didn't stay still that long. Generally, if I had a cold or something, they always wanted to wait on me and doctor me up and all that sort of thing. But this particular time that I was laying on this couch and I could not get up, and I saw these two pair of eyes looking down at me. I saw misery in those eyes, you know. I saw pity in those eyes. Mama is sick. Mama doesn't have a cold. And we can't get Mama up. You know, I'm telling you something, my friends. Now, that's been over 23 years ago. But there's many times when I look into my son's eyes and my daughter's eyes, that comes to me, you know. Because I'm not in this program to stay sober for them. I couldn't possibly be doing that because they've made me pretty pissed off with them between the 23 years I've been sober. So I'm not staying sober for them. I'm staying sober for Ollie. But nevertheless, there are certain things, and that is one of the things that every once in a while, there is when I am around them, which isn't too often, but once in a while when I'm around them and I see them looking at me with such a gleam in their eyes, and I walk up to them and I hold their face between my hands and I kiss them. And it's there, and I try my best to kiss them right there. And it's, what's that for? That's because I love you. But it's not only because I love them, it's because I have never seen that look in their eyes from that day till this, you know. See, eyes are the wind of the soul. And you see somebody that loves you very dearly, standing, looking down at you, and you know they love you, and you love them, and you can't get up. And they don't know what's the matter with you, but you know. Oh, my God. But nevertheless, finally, when I did condescend to call A, isn't that a duck? You know, a drunk can be so damned important. You know. And ain't it awful when he says there's nothing on earth no greater than him and he can't get up out of his own puke and thinks he's important. You know, condescend to do something. Well, anyway, finally that day came that I looked in the book. But I knew he was lying. It wasn't in the book. I knew it wasn't going to be there. It said, if you ever need us, we'll be the first number in the book. And I looked, and there it was, you know. So I dialed the number, and I said, I have a friend out here. I think she's losing her mind. Would you send somebody out to talk to her? And the lady said, my tongue's about that thick. She said, would you like to have somebody? Oh, thank you, bartender. First free drink I've had in a long time. She said, would you like to have somebody to come out and talk to you? And I said, oh, no, 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 goodbye. Well, a short time later, relatively short time later, I don't know, 24, 48 hours or something rather, but anyhow, I went back, and I called that number again, and I finally consented, you know, to give her my name, of course, and where I live. She said, we'll have someone call you. And she had this old biddy call me up, and this old biddy said, now, you've got anything to drink out there, get rid of it. I did. I drank it up. But, you know, alcohol is everything this book here tells you is, my dear. It's everything. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Now, just about time for me to go to that first meeting, a couple of lush-head buddies of mine came by there, and I was rather in the state of zombieism. That's if you drink, you don't get too drunk, because you're already drunk, and if you don't drink, you don't get sober, because, you know, you're just not wrapped too tight, you know, anymore. And, but these two lush-head buddies of mine came by there, and they gave me a couple of drinks of something, and it was the same as pouring coal oil into dying embers. I got drunk, you know, cunning, babbling, and powerful. She took me to that meeting, and when she got in there with me, bless her heart, three other gals jumped up and said, they thought I was going to die, and they're going to get to be my pallbearer, because they said, we'll help you with her, you know. And those old gals, I'm going to tell you something, honey, we did some sponsoring in those days. See, we didn't have all these newfangled things that the government puts a lot of money into and all like that, you know, but you let the government take it out, then you'll be back to us again, you know. We love you, you know. We don't want to exploit you or explore you. We want to be an example to you, you know. But then nevertheless, they did some sponsoring. We did some sponsoring in those days. You know, I tell you one of the things. Now, I'm not against people. See, I know that the world is weaker and wiser and some people need it, you know, different or something like that. But then I'll tell you one thing. When you have to come off of it that way, I mean, come off of it that way, you know, with two people walking you up and down and all that sort of stuff. I'm going to tell you something, hon. You hold on to it because you don't want to go through that no more. Good Lordy, you know. Nobody's standing there, you know, to give you a bag of pills to make you crazier than what you are or none of that kind of stuff. But, you have them good old-fashioned sponsors, honey, and you'd be so damn sick, you know what doing is. Come on, you go into a meeting and you go sit there, you don't know whether you're going to fall out or not. And they tell you, sit up straight and listen. Oh, shit. I don't want to go do that no more. I'm telling you. You know? And you say, I want to go to the bathroom. They think you want to get out. So they say, okay, I'll take you. They wouldn't even let you pee by yourself. You know? The way it was, you know? But nevertheless, and then they did something then, you know, they throw that who me at you. I mean, they put that who me on you. You better believe it. And make you answer the questions, you know. This gal, bless her heart, I was scared of her because she had buck teeth and I know if she's going to bite me or not. She'd start reading this who me and she'd say to me, just answer yes to three, dear, and you're in. Just answer. I thought she was getting 50 cents a yes or something. I don't know. But it was the damnedest questions I ever heard in my life at that time. See, I know I needed something and I needed help and I was scared to death and all that sort of stuff, but I just thought this was one of the most weird outfits, you know, I'd ever seen. And then they would tell me, "We want to be your friend." And I thought, "You sure in hell are hard up for friends if you want me to." But the questions, you know, they were silly, I thought. It went something like this, you know. She'd ask me a question, she'd read off of this to me. "Is drinking cloudy your reputation?" Why, if you've been in a fog 20-some years, you don't know if it's cloudy or not. And I'd try to answer some kind of way, I'd just sit and look at her right stupidly. Then she would come on up with another one there about, well, of course, the craziest one I ever heard her say was, "Do you prefer to drink alone?" Now, that was a crazy question. If I'm buying it, yes. If you buying it, no. But you talking about hanging in there, I really tried my best to hang in there. See, I'm going to tell you something. I didn't have anywhere else to go. I had nowhere else to go. Because I had long run out of everything and everybody. See, I didn't have people begging me to straighten up and all that sort of thing. But will you please? People just had gotten sick of me. You know, lots of times people are sick of you long before you have sense enough to know it. You know, you know, sometimes you think you were the belle of the ball. You ain't shit. Paul, I don't know. Forgive me, I didn't mean to say that. But, you know, sometimes, you know, we think that we are so great and people are so happy to have us around. Oh, no, they're not. No, you just, you know, kidding yourself. So I said to one of my sponsors, and I love that old gal. I think she's the only one. No, I think there's another one still living. Anyway, I said, "Mary, where do we go from here?" She said, "You just begun, dear." She says, "This is going to be a lifetime journey for you." She says, "This is a lifetime trip." Well, I said, "No, I don't want to go on no more trips. I've had enough of them." She said, "Well, look at it. It's a journey." And that, my friends, is how I've tried, and I'd like to share with you, how I've tried to look at this, and it is. I call it my journey into sobriety. Each day is my journey into sobriety. You know, when one gets ready to go on a journey and he or she has a car, the first thing that's very necessary is to take his or her car to a reputable mechanic and have him to go over it from stem to stern. You don't want to get out on the road and the thing falls apart. So sometimes, and many times it is very necessary when you and I decide to sober up, that we do go to a reputable physician. I don't mean a Librium or a Valium physician either. I mean a reputable physician so that he goes over your gut. And sees that you and your liver and so forth is working pretty good there, you know. Because you're going to meet enough psychiatrists around the AA table. You got some great ones right there. You don't need none of them other boys, you know. Unless they're alcoholics, you know, unless they're good alcoholics. And of course, I shouldn't say those things, but I do. And then as you start out on your journey into sobriety, after you're feeling pretty good, you know, I mean, go to these meetings whether you're feeling good or not, go on anyway, but you know, while you go to the doctor, go see that your guts is all together. Then when you start out on your journey, there's something else that is of utmost importance. And that is that you have four good tires. You need five, but you should have four very good ones. The first one must be communication, so that you and I can talk and share with one another. The next is identification, that you and I can really and truly identify with each other. The next is self-examination. Let me look at myself. The fourth, for me, must be determination. Many times you will hear people say, now there's no muss in the Pilgrim. You make your own muss. The hell there ain't. You must read the big book. There are some of that. Because you know what I did? I went through that book and I picked out each and every one of them and put a line under it and handed that old cat that was talking about, there ain't no muss in there. Page 43, 46 and start on in there. You're going to find it, you know. So, Sometimes when you say there's no muss, you must not want to stay sober. You know, you do it your way. And then again, as one begins to prepare himself on his journey into sobriety, you've got to have a map. Generally at home, we go to AAA and they will route out a way to tell you to go, you know. Living in Ann Arbor as I do, if I wanted to go south, 10 to 1, no 10 to 1 about it, I know what the man would say. He would tell me in short order, now, you just take, if you want to go to Kentucky from here, you just go over here and get on 23 south to I-75. And if you stay on that, you will not miss it. You'll come right into it. He said, I doubt seriously whether you'll go past your destination where you want to go. That's what the big book tells us. That's what that gentleman just read here. Rarely have we seen a person fail that has thoroughly followed our path. You know? It's routed out for you. There it is, right there. You know? Now, there's another thing that is very important. And one thing that can really bust your huffle when you're going on a trip or a journey, and you get a ticket with out-of-state license, brother, they'll soak you. You better believe it, you know? So it is well to obey the signs that one sees along the road. Now, so it is well that you and I obey these 12 steps, you know? Because this is our medicine. These are our directions, you know? God gave us these 12 steps. See, the world was so sick, he gave us 10 doses of medicine, the 10 commandments, but we were so damn sick we couldn't understand them, so he had to give us 12 doses, you know. But as we start out on our journey, and we said to now we must obey the signs that we see along the road. I make that a must. One of the first signs and the most frequent sign that we see along the road is a stop sign, is it not? And we identify that with the first step where we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable. There's a stop sign right there. Now, I ran through every stop sign that you possibly could. You know, you will not see a sign that says taper off, it says stop. Because I don't believe there's a policeman nowhere going to fall for that. Well, I missed off my taper. No, you don't hear that. Same thing in AA. There can be no tapering off. The sign says stop. You know. I ran through that. Lying. Hiding. Stealing. Now, this business of lying and hiding and stealing, stealing from yourself mentally, physically, spiritually, and financially in every other way. Lying and now isn't it a doggone shame? Here you are, you grown, go out and work every day, and you buy your alcohol or whatever it is you're gonna buy as a drink, bring it in there, and you gotta lie about it. You need anytime I got to lie about something I bought, I need to stop. And you bring it home and hide it, and it's not even Christmas time, you know. So now you gotta hide something that you bought. Now you know if you got to go out and buy something and then bring it home and hide it, yeah, and then lie about it for a chaser. Somebody says, what's that doing there? I don't know. that's nuts. Yeah. Then you get to the place where you gotta, you know, you're no longer pouring the glass, or, you know, if you do, or you have company, you have to gulp it down real fast. You know, you go out in the kitchen, you know, and you got all them little insult glasses about like that, you know, and you have to go out there and get you one of them gratitude glasses like that. And then you have to gulp it real quick out of the bottle, then go back in and serve your company with all them little insult glasses. And here it is, it'd be colder than hell, and, you know, you'd gulp it down so fast you got tears run down your eyes, and you're talking about, ooh, my hay fever is so bad. The lie again. And then begin to justify all of this. You know, justification and rationalization. Oh, brother, that is it. You know what a friend of mine told me about when it comes to this program about rationalization? He said, rationalization is just like masturbation. You're screwing yourself. And you know, I think he was right. That we so very frequently run through is creating anxiety in other people. You know, oh, we just love to create anxiety, get everybody upset, you know. You know, you come home and you haven't got sense enough, you haven't got courage enough or nerve enough or whatever it is to say, I think I'm going out for a little while, so you get everybody upset, you know. You start walking the floor, get everybody upset, so they say, what's the matter? You're making me nervous. See, I'm going to tell you that you're making me nervous, so you tell me to hurry up and get the hell out of there, you know. I haven't got the guts to say I want to walk out for a while. No, I got to create anxiety, get everybody upset. And then, you know, well, I think I was. Well, where are you going? And finally, the person will say, look, I wish you would get out of here. See, you don't want me in my own house. That's all I want you to do is tell me to get out, you know, one of those kind of things. So my friends, when it comes down to that first step where we admit we're powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable, you'd better believe that's just one itty bit of the stop signs that I ran through. I ran through every one of them. All the lying and stealing and cheating and conning and conniving and all that sort of thing, you know. Somebody was always, before I ran out of friends, they would tell me, you know, I didn't have but one person ever told me I shouldn't drink, and that was my cousin in Ohio. He used to tell me, the rest of them tell me, just don't drink so much. And I had an old biddy friend of mine, she's about 2 days older than Rain, and she needed me, you know. She didn't want me to stop drinking, she just wanted me to stop getting drunk so quick, you know. See, she, she'd like to take me with her because she, you know, when we'd go to bars, well, it was like this. She'd about already shot her wad already, you know. And she felt that no self-respecting gentleman would buy the young dollar drink without buying the old dollar drink. And it worked that way. I played on both teams. I know how it goes. She'd give me all the antidotes, you know, she'd always say. I tried to tell her how I felt. I'd tell her how sick I got. And I would try to tell her about my hangovers. And she would tell me, now, well, you know, you drink too fast, dear. She said, now, what you need to do, and you won't get sick tonight before we go out if you'll just drink a little olive oil. And you won't vomit so badly. That's the craziest thing I ever heard. The only difference between after drinking the olive oil and going out and coming home, instead of just being a long, tall drunk, I was a long, tall, greasy, puking drunk. And then she'd try to tell me about, I'd try to tell her, rather, about my hangovers. She said, oh, you don't have to have hangovers. See, misery loves company. You know that? Misery loves company, she said. You don't have to have hangovers. Now, what you really should do, you can get you a bottle of beer, and just take the top off of it and set it down beside the bed and let it get flat. And you drink that first thing in the morning, you won't have a hangover. I don't know whether that works or not. Ain't no way in hell I could go to sleep with a full bottle of beer down there. No, I don't know if it works. Maybe it works, maybe it don't. I don't know. But there's one thing that I found out as I traveled on in my journey into sobriety. We now see a sign on the road that says yield, you know, and I identify that with the second step, where we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Yield. Yield, which tells me you'd better give over before you give out. Now, you know, you see that sign you're traveling down the road and it says yield, and here you are in a Volkswagen. You say, I ain't going to yield, and here comes a Mack truck. You're going to wish you had a yield. Yeah. So many times, you know, we might hear people say, well, I do have a problem with the spiritual part of the program. Well, oh, you have a problem with the whole program, and the whole program is spiritual as far as that's concerned, yeah. Well, I just can't, you know, I can't buy it. Of course you can't buy it. It's not for sale. It's not for sale. If this was for sale, all of us in here would be on the welfare, you know. Couldn't afford it. You'd run out of money. You really and truly could not afford it, yeah. Reminds me a little Sharon there took me shopping today. If that child had heard and brought me home, I'd be able to qualify for welfare before I left here, you know, because some beautiful stores here in this town. Then we look at that second step where we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves that could restore me to sanity. What does it mean but sane thinking? Sane thinking, any time, any person, place, or thing is so important that I got to get drunk about that person, place, or thing. It is too important for me. I don't need it, you know? And then, you know, again, we hear many times people that want to tell us, well, you know, I just can't buy the guy, bitch, you know. After all, I've got my doctor, and I got my psychiatrist, so I don't need AA. Oh, Lord have mercy, you know. You know, I just told my now, with between my doctor and my psychiatrist, I can stay sober. Well, I didn't say that AA is the only way that you can stay sober, but it sure has got the best track record I know of, you know. So, okay, but, you know, I look at it like this. Let's be honest about it. You know, do you remember what your mother taught you at her knee about Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall and Humpty Dumpty had a great fall? And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Why? Well, I'll tell you why. We will look at all the good doctors as the king's horses, because all good doctors work like a horse. I said good doctors work like a horse. We will look at the psychiatrists as king's men, because, you know, they try to be so uppity anyway, you know. So we'll look at them as the king's men. Now, why is it that the king's horses and the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again? For the same reason that all the good doctors and all the good psychiatrists, and they're going to keep you sober. You see, what happened in Humpty Dumpty's case is the same thing that happens to us. They call on the king's horses and they call on the king's men, but they forgot to call on the king. You know? These people are good, but they're only aids to the king. The book says God could and would if he was sought. You know? Says so in the book. Says so. These people are good. We need them. But they're only aids to the king. And there was Humpty Dumpty, like a lot of us, or we're like him, one of the two. First of all, he's sitting on the wall. Indecision. No wonder the bastard fell off. You know. So as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, wrong way, do not enter. Let's look at the third step. You'll see that sign many times. Wrong way, do not enter. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood him. When I get to the place where I've got to do it my way, wrong way, do not enter. How many times haven't I said, you know, and you will find some people today, well, you know, that's all right, but I got to do it my way. Oh, no, 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 no. My way got me into more trouble. You know, that's all right for Frank Sinatra to sing, he did it his way. He's making money. I wasn't making none, you know. No, no, no. You know, let's look at what the step says. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to. See, there's one word there we don't look at. The book says, the step says. It doesn't say over to God. It says made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. You know. Care of. You know, when you take your money down to the bank, you don't give it to those people. You put it in there, the care of those people. See, you give your life and your will to God, you can take it back any time you want to. But I tell you one thing, every time you take it back, you lose interest. keep taking your money down there to the bank all the time, and you down there the next day taking it back, or 15 minutes later, honey, you ain't gonna have no interest. See, you can draw on that interest. And that's what that step says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And, you know, it's a privilege. I'm not telling you it's easy. It's not easy. I know it isn't easy. See? But it's a privilege. But can you tell me who else wants the life of an alcoholic? Who else wants it? I don't know of anybody. Only it would have to be a loving God that would accept the will and the life of an alcoholic. So, my friends, when I make up my mind, well, I've got to do it my way, oh, yes. You know, you say, well, you know, I can't do that step all the time. Well, sometimes you have to turn your will and your life over to care for God 500 times a day, sometimes more than that. But he's there, and he will accept it. But every time, you know, that word decision comes up. See, decision determines one's destiny. Those three D's. Decision determines one. When I get up in the morning and I make that decision, that has determined my destiny for that day. And every once in a while during the day when I want to, you know, want to do it my way, I say, wait a minute, what kind of decision you make this morning? You fixing to screw up what little destiny you got left here, kid. And at your age, you ain't got a hell of a lot left, so you better hang in there. But the benefits that one reaps are magnificent. Many times, we can turn our will and our lives over to the care of God until something goes wrong. As long as everything's going smooth, oh yes, I turn my life, my will, and care of God, everything's going cool. But you know, let something go wrong, oh, God ain't acting right, you know. Oh, I asked him for something, he didn't give it to me. He did, he give you the divine snub. You ain't ready for it yet. Yeah. But sometimes when things, you know, start going badly, or, you know, just not falling in line like you wanted, so then, after all, I'm going to take my will back. Now, you know, if you say, well, you know, things just aren't, everything's going along wrong, so I'd better do something about this. Well, that's the time you have to hang in there. You know, and you get up on a plane there, and, the pilot and everything's going, everything's real nice and lovely. And finally, all of a sudden, they flash on that sign that says, fasten your seatbelt. And the pilot says, we're going to have a little choppy weather here. Do you ask that man, look, man, are you going to have choppy weather? Let me out. No. You fasten that seatbelt and you hang in there, you know. Maybe you didn't particularly like the person that was sitting inside of you, but all of a sudden when that light flashes on to fasten that seatbelt and the plane ain't fixing to land, you even now get friendly with him, you know. Oh, there, you know. So the choppier the weather, the tighter you better fasten that seatbelt. That's it, because that's where it's at, you know. That's where it is. His line is never busy. As we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road. It says, road under construction. It's that fourth step. That's a tough titty, but you need the milk. Road under construction. When one is making a searching and fearless moral inventory of himself, the road is definitely under construction. Now, I don't know what kind of winters you people have here, but I'm going to tell you, we sure have some hell-fired winters there in Michigan. You'd better believe it. And last one was something else. And practically every road down there in Michigan now is under construction. Why? During the winter, enormous amounts of salt was poured on the road. And salt has a way of eating at the road. It eats it up. Let's look at that salt. See, during the winter of my life, during that winter, that's during those terrible times of my drinking, that resentment that I poured was worse than any salt that could eat away at the road, you know. And that caused my road to be under construction. That was necessary for me to take this searching and fearless moral inventory because of these resentments that at one time I let eat away at me because I was not woman enough, not big enough to do anything about them. I drank about them. Then another thing that might cause the road to be under construction, many times there's holes in the road. And these holes have to be filled with something. Not woman enough, not big enough to do anything about them. I drank about them. Then another thing that might cause the road to be under construction, many times there's holes in the road. And these holes have to be filled with something. You ever find those holes in your life? Those holes, those vacancies that alcohol left there, that emptiness, that's what it's talking about. When you can be in a room this big with three times as many people, if you could get them in here, and you still felt lonely. That emptiness, that vacancy, it's there, you know. And it has got to be filled with something. It has got to be filled with something. See, alcohol leaves. Alcohol makes holes and leaves holes in your life. Where there was a time, at one time, we went different places with our friends and our families and so forth and so on. But alcohol got the best of me. And on Sunday mornings and holidays and every other day, as far as that's concerned, I drank all the time. And people, the world went on about its business. And I said, where is everybody? Where was everybody? Well, you were sitting there drunk. You know, all the things that I used to do, all the reading that I had done, all the other things that I had enjoyed, alcohol took over. And there was that vacancy. And when I take a searching and fearless moral inventory and I ask myself why I was so lonely, why the vacancy, why the holes? Alcohol ate those holes in there. I let it do that. And another thing that causes a road to be under construction, in many parts of the city where I live, they probably do it here, heavy trucks are not permitted to go because trucks put a great deal of pressure on the road. It causes the road to deteriorate. Look at the pressure that I put myself under. We want to say our job put us under pressure, this put us under, I put me under pressure. You know why? The more pressure that I put myself on, the more excuse I had to drink. Yeah, I would volunteer for dog catcher, anything, yeah? Because I wanted to be under pressure. First, I wanted to be under pressure because I wanted to be important to people. How's a drunk going to be important to anybody? You know. I wanted people to see me. I don't know what the hell for. I had nothing to offer. I wanted to impress people. So anything anybody said volunteer to do, I did that. But finally I got so drunk I couldn't volunteer to do anything, you know. And then they quit letting me volunteer because they know I wasn't going to be able to. But see, I wanted this pressure. Many of us today don't realize that most of the pressure that you're under, you put yourself under because why? Want to be noticed, you know, on those kind of things. And then that gives you, oh, shh, be quiet. Mother's under so much pressure. Daddy's under so much pressure. That's why he drinks. Hell, he put himself under that pressure so he could get drunk, you know. So we have to look at it. You might as well tell it like it is, you know. And then again, another thing that causes the road to be under construction is change of temperature. Sudden change in temperature causes the road to buckle. And brother, who can change in temperature any more than we can when we're drinking? Yeah. From hot to cold right quick. Where one day everything was just lovely, and the next day everything was all wrong. The same thing, but it was all nice one day, and the next day it was all wrong. Why? You know, why? How in the world am I going to get along with you when I can't get along with myself? Because I'm living a life of pretense, that's why. And then again, another thing. Now it tells us, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of who? Ourselves. And it says moral inventory. It does not say amoral, meaning you have no morals, or nor does it say immoral. It says searching and fearless moral inventory. Now many times when the road is under construction, that line down the middle, that white line that says you stay over here and you stay over here, it gets rubbed out because of the traffic, the weather, and everything else. The same thing, searching and fearless moral inventory. Morals got rubbed out. Have you ever said, you know, when I get that bad, That's beneath my morals. When I get that bad, I quit, you know. Oh, that's beneath my morals. I keep on drinking whiskey, alcohol, rub that line out completely, you know. There was no line, you know. There was a time I said, oh, no, I don't pull off that. No. But you just keep on drinking. That's going to rub that moral line right out one way or the other. It's going to rub it out. Oh, yeah. And that's when you begin to feel that guilt and that remorse. Because all those things that you said you wouldn't do. Alcohol's going to say, oh, yes, you will. And you will. So the line gets rubbed out. But you and I, through the grace of God, and many times in taking inventory, they always say, well, you know, all I want is justice. Don't ask for justice. You might get it. Ask for mercy. You know? Mercy, not justice. Now we see a sign in the road that says, slow, do not fast. Slow, do not fast. Admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. Oh, this step scared the living hell out of me when I first saw it. I told my sponsor, I said, no way in the world am I going to take any fifth step. She said, I know you're not because you don't know what it means. Which I didn't. Admit to God, ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature. Now, what are we talking about, the exact nature of our wrong? Motive. You know, motive. It is not so much what I did, but my motive for doing it. Why? Your motive for doing it. Right, you take a child. If a child wets his clothes because he doesn't know any better, that's one thing. If he wets his clothes, shall we say, because he's ill, that's another thing. And then if he wets his clothes just to get attention, that's another thing, isn't it? You know, you'll have the back of your hand. Motive. What was his motive? All right. If he's ill, we hadn't been taught any better. But you see, you know, you and I were ill, but our illness is one of those threefold illnesses. You know, you can't get by on this step of saying, well, you know, I was sick. Sure, you were sick. You know, you were sick. But let's also look at it like this. You just took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. It didn't say took a searching and fearless moral inventory of me, of ourselves when we was drunk. Because by the time you got to the fourth step, you're supposed to be sober. Yeah. So we take a searching and fearless moral inventory of me. What kind of person am I? Whether I am drunk or sober. What kind of person am I really? Now, let me look at my motives. I'm sober now. You know. But then, you don't beat and bang your head against the wall. We just become honest with ourselves. Many times when one... This one here, I don't know about you, I can only talk about Holly. What was my motive? First and foremost, do you know, if we would look at ourselves honestly, because we're not all that rotten and you're not all that bad, the biggest majority of mess that you got into it because you were lonely, weren't you? Because through the use of alcohol, you had withdrawn from everybody, or everybody had withdrawn from you. It was near and dear to you. And loneliness set in. See, loneliness has caused more crime than poverty ever dreamed of. The lonely person gets in trouble. See. Oh, sometimes we go out and you get into this kind of thing, and you come back and that kind of thing, and you brag about, oh, yeah, I did this and I did that. You want to make everybody think you did these things because you were a big shot or a hot shot or something. You didn't do them because, just be honest about it, you didn't do all these things because you were a big shot or a hot shot or so great. You did it, damn it, because you was lonely. You had run out of everything. I had run away from everybody, and what I hadn't run away from had run away from me. And human beings being human need human beings, and brother, you can get into a hell of a lot of trouble just because you got lonely. Because you had too much guilt and too much remorse. And not enough courage to go back and say, look, I'm sorry. So I'll go out and I'll do this and do that on my own. Because I was lonely. You know. It says the exact nature. What was the nature of it? Loneliness. Loneliness can get you in an awful lot of trouble. So we look at the fifth step. Most times, you know, you say, oh, my gracious, when you first look at it, you think you're fixing to write your epitaph or something. It's not like that, my And then again, it gives you a break. The hardest thing about taking it, when it says admit to God, ourselves, and another human being, do you know the hardest thing about the fifth step is admitting it to yourself? That's it. Now, admitting it to yourself, you know, you get out on your knees and you know, you say, oh God, I'm a louse. But the thing of it is, the exact nature of your lousiness, that's what we want to talk about, you know. And then again, there's another outer step and another human being. See, they could shorten that step, but again, say another person. But they know what they was talking about when they wrote it. See, another person can be a very cold, calculating person. But a human being, that tells me I'll talk to somebody that has warmth, somebody has compassion, somebody that has common sense. Somebody's not going to say, oh, you poor little itty-bitty thing, I know they did this to you. But they're going to talk to me as woman to woman, you know. Honestly, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about, the exact nature. And as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we see a sign in the road that says the detour. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Yeah? Many times, when we see this sign, a detour, you know what it means. I don't have to tell you. It means go the other way, detour. But as the big book tells us, we thought we could hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. So some of these character defects, I think I can still hold on to. But I got a detour. I got to go in the opposite direction. You see, these character defects that I have, and God in heaven knows that I have my share of them. You better believe it. See, like when you're driving down the road, and you figure, sign says the detour. And you say, well, why must I detour? Well, you know, the storm was here and the bridge got washed out. Oh, well, I know the bridge got washed out before, but I made it. Mm-hmm. You made it that time. But will you make it this time? So I had better pay attention to that sign that says the detour. Go in the opposite direction, entirely ready to have God do it. Remove all. And that little bitty word, all, that's the important word there, all of them. Oh, you say, you know, no, I just can't, you know, I just can't do that. I want to hold on to something, you know. We just got to have hold on to something. Now, if you went to the doctor and you had appendicitis or gallbladder trouble or whatever else that you could possibly have, and it's causing you pain, it hurts, the doctor says, that's got to come out. But you say, oh, no, doctor, uh-uh. Don't you dare touch this. This is my gallbladder. You leave my gallbladder. Let me ask you a question. Jealousy is a character defect, and now jealousy hurts. It hurts to be jealous. Why do you want to hold on to it? That hurts. Envy hurts. That's those things are malignant. Yeah. Sometimes anxiety hurts. That's contagious. Why do I want to hold on to something that hurts me? Yeah. Am I that sadistic? No. You go to the doctor to find out what's wrong with you, and he tells you, and sometimes he says, that's got to come out. Here we come to the greatest of all physicians to find out what's wrong with you, and it tells you there, entirely ready to have God remove it. And he says, oh, no, I don't want to get rid of that. And it's hurting you. No wonder we need to be restored to sanity. We want to hold on to things that hurt. You know? So I have to detour. And as I travel on my journey into sobriety, I see a sign on the road that says, bumps and curves. Those are little words, aren't they? Bumps and curves, but they carry great significance, a bump and curves. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You see, my shortcomings, those are the clothespins that hold resentments on the line. Yeah? All of these shortcomings that I got to hold on to. So humbly ask him to remove them because, see, that's the clothespin that holds my character defects on the line there. Yeah. So I humbly ask him to take the clothespins out. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Three of the greatest that I have found, pretense, you know, procrastination, and reservation. Pretense. Pretending to stay sober for yourself, and you're not staying sober for yourself. You know? In other words, I'm still conning, I'm still manipulating. I'm staying sober for a certain event, a certain circumstance, to get a certain person to do this or that. Pretend. Pretending that I am staying sober, you know, on meetings, on nights when I go to meetings. You know. Pretending to stay sober. But I got some cough medicine that's way out. Pretend. Mm-hmm. Pretend. You see, if I'm going to... See, my sobriety is the only thing that I have that is I know is mine. Anything else that I got, somebody can steal it from me. Or I can lose it. You see, you don't lose your sobriety. And nobody steals it from you. You throw it away. That's what happens. And somebody, oh, so-and-so upset me so bad I lost my sobriety. You didn't have none, no, how? No, you didn't. You can't steal my sobriety. It's mine. Or you say, oh, so-and-so, that person is coming to program now, and he's going to tear up the whole program now. Oh, no, he may tear up his program, but he ain't going to tear up my program. You know? But not mine, because mine's in that book, and it's in me. He might tear up some crap he's got, but he ain't going to tear up nothing of mine. You know? That's the way it is. That's the way it's got to be. So, when I look at pretense, and I say somebody else is tearing up this or tearing up that, that is giving me an excuse to pretend. Now, do I really pretend my sobriety, or is it for real? You know, sometimes you can stay dry a long time, but is it really sobriety? It doesn't make any difference about the number of years, because quantity doesn't mean anything. Quality. That's what I work on. Quality sobriety. Pretense. Who are you really and truly staying sober for? And if the word is not yourself, then let's start all over again tonight and make it that way. Another, shall we say, shortcoming is this old thing, procrastination. Always putting it off. Oh dear, we must procrastinate. Yeah? In other words, I'm still not quite ready to be honest. Put off this and I put off that. Well, you know, I'll go back to, I'm going to go to AA, you know, just as soon as I get my license back on my car. I'll go back to AA and I get my license. If you wanted to drink, you wouldn't need no license. You'd walk after it, wouldn't you? You'd go to it anyway. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't go to AA, but you know, I'm going just as soon as I get something to wear. Oh, we girls are good at that. Just as soon as I get something to wear. What did you wear the night you did that strip tease? You know? Well, you know, I don't have anybody to keep the kids. I'd go to A, but I don't have anybody. When you was laying there on that couch drunk, who was keeping the kids then? The kids was keeping you, wasn't it? Procrastination. So we put off and we put off. You know, I wish I could want to stay sober. I wish I could want to stay sober. He's putting it off. And then there's reservation. Well, you know, I don't believe I could be an alcoholic because, you know, after all, there's no alcoholics in my family. Well, then you break the family tradition and you be the first. Yeah. Well, you know, after all, I still, as far as pills are concerned, you know, well, this is procrastination and reservation. You know, I really don't think that they're going to upset me too bad, you know. Somebody said, well, why don't you tell your doctor to quit giving you that crap? You're an alcoholic. You don't need... Well, you know, after all, I intend to tell him the next time I go that I am an alcoholic. But, you know, I just can't tell him right now. Just as soon as I get over the hump, I'll tell him. Mm-hmm. Well, but you see, I tell you, I have to take, you know, I'm having so much trouble sleeping. And this is terrible. I just can't lay down at night and go to sleep. I need something to help me sleep. I'm tired of laying there counting sheep. Well, talk to the shepherd and you don't have to count sheep. Now let's briefly look at 8 and 9 due to the lateness of the hour. I promised the lady tonight I wasn't going to talk very long. I know she'd never invite me back again. She didn't invite me anyway, though, far as I'm concerned. You know, now when we get there to that steps where we are going to talk about amends, You know, that we became willing. That too is a little rough, you know. Because I realize when it comes down to making amends, and it says that we became entirely willing to make these amends. And it tells me I made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. There's a sign in the road that says, watch for ice on the bridge, because it's there. See, the first amend that I have to make is to me. And that is, how in the world am I going to forgive you if I can't forgive myself? You know, if I can forgive you, but I can't forgive me, I must make amends to me. I have to learn to forgive myself. I have to learn to love myself. Because anytime anybody comes to me and lays that jive on me, oh, I love you more than I do myself, is no, you don't, baby. I don't be bothered with you. If you love me more than you do me, then yourself, what are you up to now? See, the book of books tells me to love thy neighbor as thyself, which means, okay. See, if I'd ever loved some of my neighbors or treated some of my neighbors the way I treated myself, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be in penitentiary somewhere. You know? So the thing of it is, when I made a list of all persons that I've harmed and became willing, I had to put a holly down. Because I had harmed me mentally, physically, spiritually, in every other way. To thine own self be true. When I come to make amends to you, and I still have not straightened out my bag, there is always that possibility. If I don't have a good spiritual foundation and you reject me, I'd better watch. There may be ice on the bridge. There may be, not everybody, I hope it never happens to you. But sometimes when one goes to make amends, he or she is told to get lost, drop dead, or anything. And if I do not have a good spiritual foundation, I might slip, I might fall. So I better watch for ice on that bridge. Sometimes, you know, we think that without making it, well, I'm just going to walk on back in, you know, I ain't going to make no amends, I'm just going back like nothing had never happened, you know. Watch for ice on the bridge, baby, you know, because it is there. Oh, sure, it is wonderful. This is one step that it is, none of them are, shall we say, well, I just rolled into that. Oh, no, I didn't. I had some amends I had to make. But I had to first see that my own house was in order, just in case there was rejection. Because if my own house had not been in order, and if I had not been staying sober for Holly when I got rejected, yeah, that's when you slide on that ice. Because I don't believe in slips. I believe people just get drunk, you know. That slip stuff is something else, you know, I don't believe that. Slips has got lace on them. You got wrong. You know? We have to watch for that, you know. And then again, you know, sometimes we want to be accepted back so much. Watch for ice on the bridge now. That we will even down, admit to things that we didn't do. You see, the big book will tell me, and it tells me I do not become a doormat. And I don't have to. There's a very thin line between humility and stupidity, you know. Yeah. Watch it. Because there's ice on the bridge, you know. I hope you never run into it. And as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign on the road that says, no U-turn. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. No U-turn. Now, along with that sign, many times you might see a sign that says, for authorized vehicles only. Now, that's for people that have come in the program and know everything, have took a course in AA, and so now they know it. Okay, you're authorized to go right on back out there again if you want to. You know everything, since you know so much. But I like that no U-turn, no U-turn. Let's look at some of the things that we think that can give us a reason, or an excuse. There's no reason, excuse for a U-turn. Sickness. Yeah. Well, we get sick, or somebody else gets sick in the family. Oh, I can't stand to see so-and-so suffer, so you go out and get drunk and suffer right with them, you know? Or I get a little ill myself. And here I am, I've been staying sober, so I get sick, so I got to go out and get drunk now. You know? What does God mean by letting me get sick, you know? All these years that you done been sick with alcohol, now all of a sudden you're not supposed to even catch a bad cold no more. You know? So I go out and I get drunk because I got sick. It gives me an excuse to get drunk. Oh, no, it don't. Yeah. Because, you see, all I got to do is think back, you know, when I was a child, and my grandmother, you know, for the croup or anything, she put all that honey and lemon and stuff together and put in 2-3 drops of whiskey, and that's to keep you... Honey, I was a croupiness child and the whole family. I had to keep all that. And sometimes, you know, another thing that causes us to have a U-turn is loss of a job. Like, well, I didn't get fired all while I was drinking. Now I'm sober and I get fired. This is terrible. I lost my job. Well, man's adversity is God's opportunity. Sometimes you needed to lose that job because you didn't have courage or guts enough to quit it and get another one that you liked. So you stayed there. And you hated the damn job. You hated the hell out of it. You know. As well as you did. And sometimes after we've been sober a day or two, a little while, and we figured, well, and a person serves them divorce papers under your nose anyway. Oh, you're going out and get drunk. Proves one thing. You wasn't staying sober for yourself, was you? Okay. Well, they told you if you did straight up, I'm going to do it. Well, they were going to divorce you anyhow. They didn't just divorce you for your drink. The hell, they didn't want you. You know, one of those kind of things. So you mean to tell me I'm staying sober and you're going to divorce me anyhow? Yes. So you go out and get drunk. You know what you did? You played right into their hands. They knew you was going to get drunk. So this big guy might as well go on and divorce this idiot because she's going to get drunk anyway. Yeah. So you played right into their hands. That's what you do. And it all proves one thing. That's why it says continue to take personal inventory and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. You're going to get drunk because somebody served you a divorce paper? You was going to get drunk anyway. Were you not? You wasn't staying sober for you. So he said, well, you know, after all, I got drunk. I'll just be honest. I got drunk because I was bored. Oh, I was so bored, I didn't know what to do. I went to this meeting, I just got bored. Now I got drunk because I got bored. You wouldn't go out and buy a stick of dynamite because you got constipated, would you? But one of the saddest things of all, one of the saddest things of all is when a person comes into the fellowship. You know, and for the lack of attention, you know, when you're first new in the program, you are the baby, and everybody babies you and pets you and stirs you coffee and pours it for you and everything else. And then, you know, it's just like a mother when she goes to the hospital to have a baby, you know, and here's Junior. He's about 2 or 3. He's house broke anyway. Well, Mama goes to the hospital, has a baby, and when you bring the baby home, well, you know, everybody wants to put diapers on the baby. See, Junior, he's been a baby for 2 or 3 years. You know, you got him house broke. And now the new baby's home. And everybody's making over the baby and petting the baby, you know. And Junior, you know, like this worth a damn. He's been a baby. So he figures, I want some attention. I'll fix him. I'll piss on myself, you know. And he does it. Have you ever seen people? They were the baby for, about 6 months or a year. Finally, a new person comes in and they can't take it. Instead of them helping to pamper and see that new person, they can identify with that last new person a lot better sometimes than the older person who's been around a long time, you know, because they're kind of new there together. But oh no, they don't get petted and the coffee poured for them and blowed and all that kind of stuff. So they go out and get drunk. Cute. Lack of attention. No U-turn. None of those things are enough good enough to get drunk. There's nothing good enough to get drunk. As one travels on in his journey into sobriety, now sees a sign in the road that says gas, food, and lodging, next exit. That's that beautiful 11th step where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Gas, what are you talking about? Power. What is gas to a car but power? Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. In the first step, didn't you say you were powerless? In the second step, you came to believe that you could get some power. See, in the third step, from there on in, you begin to utilize it. Power to carry that out. See, lodging, AA. See, as long as I live, I will always be in the recovery room of AA. See, when one has had an operation, and you and I have had one of the most horrendous operations. I mean, you and I have had a personality operation. No psychiatrist could have given it to you. We had to have the master physician give us this operation. Only God can give you, shall we say, a personality operation. And he can only do it then with your consent. See? So, when one is in the recovery room, there's always a very efficient nurse in there that is constantly taking your blood pressure and your temperature and your respiration and all that sort of stuff. And with the slightest deviation of any of these things, she immediately goes out and gets and calls the physician. You know. But you know, you and I have that privilege of being in the recovery room of AA. And we watch our four vital signs. I know what mine are. Pride, fear, resentment, and self-pity are my four vitals. And with the slightest deviation of any of these, I don't need to call anybody else, but I can call a physician myself. Because I'll always be in the recovery room. Yeah. But you know, when I see that road sign, yeah, I know I'm going to always have power. Because he's going to give me the power to carry it out. Yeah. Food, spiritual food. Prayer and meditation. Lodging is here where I belong. Right here. You know, there's many times when one is traveling down a beautiful highway and you are so enraptured like one would, especially here in Oregon, because this is one of the most beautiful states I've ever been in. You know, it just looks like you could reach up and grab a piece of that sky anytime. How in the world could anybody in Oregon not believe in God with a sky like that? How could you? Can duplicate a skyline like that. It is beautiful. But you know, when one is traveling down a highway, and many times one sees this sign, especially when you're tired, God, and you're very tired, and you see this sign that says gas, food, and lodging, and you feel so good, you know, and you think of that 11th step, there's always something, you know, that doesn't let you get, shall we say, too way out. You'll see a sign that'll bring you right back to reality right quick. But you say, watch for falling rocks, like you see in, shall we say, sometimes in California and in different places in Maine, Massachusetts, rather, tell you watch for falling rocks. Because you see, sometimes, you know, we get so, everything is so beautiful, we might get a little complacent, so you better watch for falling rocks, too. And what are some of those falling rocks? Just the minute you think you've got everything going along real great, and, oh, you just carried away everything, you're on cloud nine, somebody says, You know one thing, honey? You may be sober, but you're just a bigger damn fool as you always were. That's a falling rock. Sometimes you go to AA and you might even down and get a falling rock there. If you talk to too many people, if you talk to the men, then you're running after all the men. If you talk to the women, you're a lesbian. You know, they're going to say something about you. And if you don't talk to nobody, they're going to say you just come for the coffee and donuts. Because you're always going to find somebody that's going to say something one way or the other. You're going to get some falling rocks. That's why you have to stay close to the master. Now, gas, food, and lodging. It is all right there. Just stay in the recovery room. And as you travel on your journey into sobriety, you will finally see a sign in the road that'll tell you, end of divided highway. You know? End of divided highway. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You see that big old word there, result of these steps. We tried to carry the message to the alcoholic. And to practice these principles in all of our affairs. In other words, end of divided highway. I can have no two kinds of honesty. There can only be one kind of honesty. That's all. Practice principles. In other words, what it is really telling me that I can no longer, shall we say, just in order to get along with another person. Well, I won't practice the principle. I just have to give in to this kind of thing, you know. I got to keep peace. Yeah, I'm going to keep peace by practicing the principle. You know, and to try to carry the message of the alcoholic, well, you know, you might say, you know, I just don't see how a person nowadays can carry a message. You know, after all, have you been educated in the field of alcoholism? And that he doesn't have an education in the old look. Now, wait a minute. What kind? How much of a master's degree does a person need?